My name is Karen Herseth Wee. I'm from Minnesota, Northfield. Work at St. Olaf College as a secretary. And I'll be the first reader tonight. We have 6 or 8 people, and I hope each will say their name before they read poems, so that as it is recorded, it will come out as a kind of even presentation. I've been writing for quite a long time. I write for a couple of purposes. I think everyone does. One is for the love of the word, the love of the sound of it. And I think writing captures the moment. It captures something you've seen, something you've experienced. It's a new way of seeing. And after tonight's Vespers, I guess I would say it's singing with a plain voice. It's singing with the spoken voice, that there's rhythm and there's nuance and there's other kinds of things, and that in poetry, what isn't said is often just as important as what is. The first poem I'd like to read is one I just wrote yesterday, and that's not always a smart thing to do, but it seemed kind of fun. I went for a hike with a friend, and what this poem says is really a code for what we were talking about. This is the hike to Monkey Bear Falls. In the valley, a ringing bell, lots of sun, a turquoise sky holding up mountains still veined with snow. They walk into the forest, two women who don't know a lot about forests, more about the valley. They are entering the last third dimension of their lives. The way is up. Paintbrush orange against the dark forest floor. Later in switchback rocks, Queen Anne's lace. At one point, they almost turn around, a rush of melting snow out of its bed deterred. No one near to ask how far the falls, which detoured way to go. So they drop down like cats to cross on fallen logs, lichen softening the forest floor, jumbles of tree limbs every which way, mesh, a sturdy safety net that held. They'd gone around and over the cascading stream and were pressing on the trail again. When all was said and done and they were home, it came to them to ask, what would someone else have done, gone a different way? At which juncture? With what result? And who among their friends simply would have turned around and not seen the small brown diving creek bird feeding young in a damp crevasse, nor seen the falls, which were spectacular? And another thing that I know I do with my poems is to connect experience and human in motion with the land. And as many of you know, and some have lived through, the floods of the Midwest were all in the news and all in people's lives. David and I happened to be in California, but watching on television a lot, CNN News, and I ended up writing about the Red River. Red River Rampage. The great white beaches of last winter's snow recede, transform, drop into river ravines, and race north under burgeoning power. At Grand Forks, the red spreads, transmogrified as inland sea. People leave farms and homes in droves, displaced water everywhere, nightmares amass like logjam, bridges buckle. Fire appears out of nowhere in the middle of a city. Later, ruined skeletons of historic business buildings align with heaven in a posture of prayer, resembling the sacked cathedrals of Northumbria, vacant stairs where stained glass windows have been. This Dakota city on achingly flat land again survives the deluge, peopled by folks with the resilience of a pioneer wife who accidentally tips her scrub bucket over on the just cleaned ancient linoleum floor. Freed water everywhere. She drops again to her swollen knees and begins to clean. And this is a poem after a description from the newspaper about the asteroid that they think fell into the ocean on the far side of Florida and how large it is underground. This is called Asteroid. Maybe it did land off the coast of Mexico and cause giant waves to flood Florida, Toa the Boot, and beyond. Maybe it did change the mating plan of dinosaurs. But most surely, one star was brought to its knees on the Earth, a bang theory that, although there are holes in it, begins to hold up as scientists drop into the Atlantic, pull water over their heads, then emerge dry-eyed from darkest, wettest space with proof and story that this or that layer of matter on the ocean floor and beyond was begat by an asteroid. And for a while, just before God found it, total darkness shot up and out from the deep, covering the void with land. I think the last couple poems that I will read to you at this point have to do with a dire illness in our family, which we have been much concerned with lately. Our daughter has a partner, friend, lover who was just diagnosed with leukemia. They were in Salzburg at the time, only 2 weeks, and they had to fly home. And David and I have spent a good bit of time in California with them as he tries to survive this. He has a kind that he can't survive, but the miracle in it is that he has a brother with a perfect bone marrow match, and that's still in the future. But I'll read to you a couple of prayer kinds of poems that I've written because of that event. 6 a.m. alarm. Phone call from Salzburg. News. Gloriousness rested away. I walk from one side of my house to the other, then outdoors in the dark, searching for portents. The moon eclipses. A comet tears toward the center. Long flight away from everything and toward a painful climate neither deserve. They begin the brutal treatment, the deep travail. Another birth canal, Michael. Again, it is not your choosing. You will be reborn, light-framed and bald, fragile, even a freckle heavy on your skin. For now, everything is wrested away, everything future still to come. We wait, know nothing, hope for everything. Yes, we are carried on the back of hope. Leukemia, March 19 in Salzburg, begins a deep winter of holding on. Desperate for health, for medical insurance, they flee to California, her birthplace, his home. They cling to Aunt Betty's vision. In the middle of the night, she sat bolt upright from deep sleep, bathed in light, a voice in the room saying twice, Michael will be fine, Michael will be fine. That really happened, and Aunt Betty is not one to have visions. The medical clinic where Michael is near the Crystal Cathedral and near Disneyland. It was quite a thing for them to move from Salzburg because there they live next to Mozart's birthplace. In the shadow of the Crystal Cathedral we wait, putting no faith in the glass edifice itself, too aware of the cost of shattering a temporal structure, no blood in the thing itself, built on the backs of the elderly who with shaky signatures put their faith on the line and before their eyes their money turned into glass and stone. We pin our hopes on much more, on shadows, on portents, on survival strength of bone, transmogrified marrow. We demand that the numbers fall right, that chromosomes count off as they should, not as they might. We pray for that, and for the bad blood to fall away like blood between brothers, who no matter the vagaries of inheritance, stay true to each other, who even more than magically gifted doctors dare everything by acts that are predestined, will, promise, commitment, because it matters. Filled with the mud of your own star, Michael, you are glory and portent in one. Tell me, darling, how you are feeling, Earth dips low in its axis, picks up its hum. Sound of chemo in the air. You make it your own, you claim it. Lifetime Achievement Award. Since July of 94, you have been home for her. What is long? What short? Moon eclipse is nothing but shadow, yet provides comets, eon fields of light, and they go bright into the next galaxy. She comes to you each day, Michael, dressed for the occasion, a sterile yellow mask, sterile hands, an odd priestess. She ministers to your loneliness by presence alone, brings music, popcorn, science fiction videos. Touch is another matter, so little allowed. Nothing foreshadowed this sharp turn, nothing illumined it. One day the throat cried out, another day a horrible ache in shoulder, then thigh, pulled muscle unaccounted for. Strength of youth relied upon. Yet slight evil ministrations in the blood evolved completely out of your hands. Unfair, a matter that involves your very life and hers. She comes, prays, dons the yellow mask, promises to be there till you need her no more. After the yellow masks come off, he is hungry. Some things never change. How time takes, gives back. In a single day, one can notice. A body announces to its doctors, I am well. Startlingly, like it first pronounced the new word, leukemia, 2 months ago. And it ganged up on itself. Today it says, I'm coming home, hungry for bone, for the sight of lips and nose, for slow shuffles in sun next to hibiscus hedges and empty asphalt parking lots. On their patio, a white plastic chair. Soon, his body at home announcing, come, I have not eaten real food for weeks. All those times I said to the children, be careful. A mantra meant to ward off evil from the other side. Mostly it works. Then one day an illness rises on the inside. Gift of the polluted world to our daughter's partner and lover, leukemia. And we and our family and friends run to our gods, run to our most sacred places of worship, to our computers, to our shamans and wizard concoctions, even to the single lucky penny shining in a parking lot. We plead, pray, demand, cry for deliverance from this evil. And when it comes, at least for a while, we resume each our own momentum toward a time so intimate, so personal, there will be no one left who knows us to warn, be careful. And the last one, what will we all be like on the other side of this awful year? For weeks now, a torture chamber, isolation, if only alcohol were the only smell to hate. He sits upright on the edge of a straight back chair, bald, shivering, having just thrown up, diarrhea too. But when asked for shaman cure purposes, he cries, I love my life. And that is essential if he is to survive this brutal, torturous treatment, or if she is. And when he does, how will they be different? How will she? Can they pick love up where they left it, soulmates, hitchhikers heading to Salzburg, not knowing their ride detoured through a Los Angeles medical center? City of angels? Dare we count on angels that in his tiny cell of a room, invading all the interstices of his marrow, are angels? Angels to attend, sit on the edge of the bed, hold his hand when she can't, as she cannot every day in every waking hour? But can they together beat back the predators in the blood for the simple reason that this is a very good man? Lifelines extend to him from the hand of his grandpa, a fighting Irish disposition from his grandmother. Gather, you angels, guide this fantastic, torturous journey back from the edge of hell. Give him back his life and hers.
And here just so I feel like I'm speaking to more of you. My name's Erica Ray. I was here in the village for the first time for about 5 months over the summer of 95. And that's when I first really began to take writing poetry seriously. So I guess it's been about 2 years now that I've been going at it. And I really love creative journaling. And I have even tried to send some poems in to some poetry journals. And I'm growing a stack of rejection letters. So I figure, oh, someday maybe I'll, whatever. So this first poem is called Spirituality, and I wrote it this January. Does it sit in that small space of air between your hands folded in prayer? Is it in your marrow or is it your armor? Do you touch it? Like untouchable, cold museum marble. Do you bury your tears in it, grow gardenias, and whisper, hallelujah? Spirituality, do you ride it like a hurricane or a weather vane? A rodeo or a carousel? Do you walk it like a tightrope with tippy, shaky, shivered step, with arms outstretched, with 10 Bibles balanced on your brow as the Sistine ceiling curves overhead and Dante's rings crackle below? Does it float in holy water, bath water, the Nile? Do you visit it? And does it visit you in temple, on prairie? Beside death, inside birth, beneath sheets, under constellation, and without hesitation. Does it require you to travel 1,000 gravel miles on your knees? And does it expect you to say, please? Is it painted on cathedral halls, on faces of the congregation, on the white walls of meditation? Does it fill you, mend you, send you out with grace? Is it mantra? Is it mood? Is it icons? Is it food? Is it crosses? Is it bliss? Is it kisses? Is it myth? Miracle, canticle, nativity, nirvana, bead, creed, petal, plea, resurrection, reincarnation, smoke, chime, chant, cycles, idols, totems, symbols, rain, wind, flame, dirt, drum, 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 amen. Spirituality. Green is my favorite color, so this is a poem called Green. Today I am a thing of green, like a solstice or a bead. I luxuriate in sprouted, dense apparel, a fevered tangle before the jungle opera begins. I wade in cool, mossed pebbles or in heated water reeds, depending on whether or not the sun is in the waltzing mood. If you breathe me, I weave prayer shawls and sweet greenhouses into your lungs. I am a hula skirt. I am mermaid sweat. I am a thing of green, like a 2-inch Buddha or a bud. I live in the shadow of a cemetery stone, and I bid the spirits good roaming. I scatter rosemary along their airy path. When you invite me to a luncheon, I bring pea pods and peppermint and alligators. I sing soprano in a choir of August rain, kissing young ginkgo beneath its leafy clothes. I am a lifeboat, and I am the last thing a caterpillar sees before she retreats into herself, spinning toward reincarnation. This is called the naming, and this I wrote away from Holden, but I drew pieces of my journal writing from one morning after I had slept out on the tailings up here. I slept out on the second level, and it was with your brother David, and we woke up to see the sunrise and to make coffee. And so some of the images that I wrote in my journal after that is what I drew from to write this poem. So it's called The Naming. We are making strong coffee on the ledge while we wait for the sun to heave itself over the top shelf of Martin's Ridge. And then, good morning, mountain. I am yodeling with all the valley things. I am squinting up at the aqua blue, which I cannot see anymore, for the new day has exhaled a screen of brilliance. Around us, the mountainside was a flat, conforming slate gray, until this brazen morning star emptied its lungs across it. How fantastical and odd, a color that is constant in our naming of it and our stubborn perception of it, is transformed merely by the sun breathing a beam. So can we call it slate gray anymore? Oh no, I see rubbed charcoals, inky blacks with silver edging, and a lavender wash. The light is far ahead of itself, renaming the colors of this world, and we can hardly keep pace with the palette transformation. I am drinking coffee under the shine and cannot be labeled so easily now either. You call me gray, I turn to silver. Two more. And this one I wrote for my cousin Kelly. We've grown up together. She's just a year younger than I am. And she's my favorite and closest cousin. And she has two kids now. And it's just wild to imagine that, being that I feel like she and I were just kids running around together. So it's called Little Girl Mommies. And tonight, since my friend Marco's here, I'd like to dedicate it to you. Little Girl Mommies. I see you with your neatly round fullness under loose flared shirts and stretch pants. And I remember when we were 7 and 8, wearing spotted halter tops and bikinis on straight-lined bodies, cartwheeling through sprinklers with flat stomachs as reflectors for the sun. I remember us on the front patio eating orange popsicles, potato chips with ketchup, and grape pop. And today, I see you pour milk and fix vegetables, ensuring the healthy multiplication of baby cells, a lovely intertwining of maternal attention and magic biology. I remember us in light 90s, taping wings to our backs, tiptoeing across couches, whisper singing to each other, angels flying in the sky, an unearthly game alighting us into dreams. But tonight, I watch you huff and shuffle to your room where gravity and heavy belly anchor you to bed. So now I see you are a mother with sweet daughter and newly born boy. And I remember how we sat in miniature rocking chairs, smiled with our baby teeth showing, held our dollies tight with arms thin as dandelion stems, and pretended we were mommies. And This final poem is called Grounded, and I wrote it last summer, and even though I've written a few things between then and now, this is still is my favorite piece that I've written. I was having a rough time in Minneapolis and was fleeing off to Chicago to stay with a friend for a week. And so this is the only poem that I've ever written in my head without paper and pen. And so I pulled over at a rest stop to get it down before I forgot it. So this is about getting away to get grounded in a mess of emotions. When I find myself stuck in slow motion, melancholy muck, doing achy self-conscious, pulling my emotional muscles, funk in the pain tangle, love mangled, city in my face, memory dangling off of every place. Yeah, when I find myself like this, I want to be displaced. Pitch on an eastbound cumulus or a flappy little tail of a storm cloud and just let myself drip drop down through the lazy horizontal arms of afternoon gathering. Just lay myself splat flat down on a Wisconsin farm with my body 100 acres stretching, where the tallest things are cottonwood, steeple, silo, sky, and dragonfly. Where the noisiest things are legato wavelengths of landscape and liquid sound waves of river. Where the only problems to muddle through are solved in chewing cud, hoofing mud, and getting the last moon. Oh, here may my head be filled with dark dirt content. Here may I wear this solace like a chiffon leaf. And may my old grief be dislodged by boulders, and the corn silk curl comfort round my shoulder. May the petty child of jealous mind be eclipsed by clover, and all the bicker brain chatter be hushed, and may I sink lower. Till me, fill me, plow me through, plant me deep, weed me, seed me, roust me out, sprout me in, flood me, flip me, wash me down, sunny side up, and I am grounded. Thanks.
House. I feel like I'm proof that you can start anytime with writing poetry. I have written poems for about 5.5 years now. I don't think I've ever written more than a schoolgirl poem before then. And it's exciting to, in the second half century of your life, to have something new to explore. And I read for the first time kind of with three other poets, and was called Rookie of the Year by the publisher that recruited me. So it's kind of nice after 50 to be Rookie of the Year. I'm going to start with a couple poems I first read actually here at Holden, I think, 3 years ago. And so I'm going to maybe read. I know I wrote, this is my first published poem. I'll read that first, and I know I read that 3 years ago. And I think I'll read that again and then go on from there. Winter Twilight. This year I found beauty in winter twilight. Limited palette of gray, white, black, blushed with pink and blue. Soft, light mounds beneath dark tracery branches. Unified canvas, pairing earth and sky in reflections not seen on summer days. Flat space, impenetrable, aloof, hiding icy, stiff reality. This year I found the beauty in winter twilight. the subtle tones of quiet, older earth to match my life. An earth enfolding many deaths, with life suspended but not gone, where wonders in connections, weavings, not isolated fireworks, in mysteries overlooked, but more substantial than in summer light. This poem also has a Holden connection. It was printed in Accent a while back, so some of you may have written it. It comes from meeting Father Martin Barrow, and I'm not good at saying it in Spanish, so people can, in San Salvador in 1987. He was one of the five Jesuits who was brutally murdered along with their housekeeper and her daughter in by the El Salvadorian military in November 16th, 1989, and I met him about a year and a half before that happened. Thank you, Martin Barrow. Before that Saturday, I was afraid of being rejected, not looking nice, not knowing what to do. After I heard you tell your story and grieved your death, with time to digest it, other experiences to echo it, my fears changed. Now I'm afraid of being alone, having pain, dying. Some people may not think you gave me a gift. And that is not to say that I don't still worry about being accepted, looking nice, knowing what to do. But at least I have fears that matter. Sometimes I wish I could talk to you again. I know where I want to go. I'd like to start with hopes that people will experience love, that the world will embrace justice. People who know me are sometimes surprised that I write kind of short poems because I'm kind of the polar opposite of what you do, maybe poetry you do, the poem. I also write pessimistic poems, and that's sort of, this is a quite short one. Through a daughter's eyes. She treasured her pen, black with chrome trim, surface luring reflections. We were in big trouble if it disappeared. I couldn't understand why a pen was so important. It was one of those first things that made me think maybe my mother was a separate person. This is one of my newer poems, Summer Night Thoughts. Hard-shelled insects pop against the screen like deftly launched kernels of corn from a popper overheat. Our minds focus and turn to the resilient ones, so prepared, unlike us in our thoughts. We've heard radioactivity will fry us like egg yolks, while species better protected will live on relentless as floodwater. What can we do to survive? Hold tightly to insight, or flap upward and pop against the screen till oblivion absorbs us and we can weather all? Since my husband says after poems like that, well, that's enough to make you want to hang yourself in the basement. I'll do something a little more whimsical. Mother was the mentor for May baskets. May 1st was the time to assemble the morsels to go inside. Is there a marguerite available? Add it to the fertile May basket. When is the right moment to deliver? When the moon is dark and the mind is far away, hang it on the doorknob and run. This is the newest poem, and it may still evolve a while, but I'll just try it out on you. At age 53, I took biology of aging and learned that axillary hair and pubic hair thins from the edges, that it's normal to lose the outer third of eyebrows with age, that graying of axillary hair is a reliable indicator of age, while graying of head hair is strongly hereditary. I knew that. My daughter is finding gray hairs at 26 like my sister did, who used that circumstance to explore color varieties. Did you know there is a hair dye called hairdresser red, so named because it is not a color ever seen on undyed heads. I have been stubborn while my hair turned white. I wanted to experience it. I matured in the 60s. I believe in the power of hair. It can't be avoided. After illness, I found out that inside me is a panic as good as anyone's. An anxiety about taking one breath after another, about lying down and never getting up again. From the upper story of my mind, I'd once looked out over life and said, I could let this go and rejoice in what I've had. I was wrong. We should copy cats. Sauntering, seeing all in sidelong glance, sure of body, total faith, turning toward a vacant sound, filling in the gaps around it. Taut until the frugal spring launches to the sailing climax, turning from the phantom prey to discover new creations, or to practice utter boredom. And a last poem, Neighbor. She called to give me 3 herb plants 2 months before she died, thyme, tarragon, and sage. I've learned before, wintering herbs is not easy. My record isn't good. And now she's dead. And so are 2 plants. Only the tarragon is left. I said goodbye to her. I was lucky. But this feels like goodbye again. A print or shawl would be simpler and guaranteed to last. 2 months till thaw, so I water and prune, move it into and out of the sun. Only spring will tell if tarragon reaches the deep, moist soil. Thank you.
My name is Catherine Smith, and I'm on staff here, kind of not really long-term, but not really short-term, because I've been here since April, so I was sort of feel like I was part of the winter. I am going to read 4 poems tonight. Outside of my life at Holden, I'm a college student and I'm majoring in English. So this is something that I've done for a while. The first poem I'm going to read, I wrote this past March when I was in Pittsburgh. It's called Sleeping Patterns. If I alter my position, you'll adjust. You sleep with the weight of your leg heavy upon mine. You'll shift your body to conform to my movements. But if I try to get up, you won't budge. That leg weighing on me like a conscience. Your body is a barricade. You block my only passage out. I write in the dark, scrawling my way across pages by the feel of it, convincing myself it's time zones that take away my ability to sleep. There's part of me that turns from you when you reach for me in the night. If I get up out of bed, I don't know if you'll still have space for me if I come back. Six months ago, I was in South Africa, and this next poem is a poem that I wrote on the flight home. And one little bit of background that might help. In Cape Town is one of the candidate cities for the 2004 Olympic Games. And in Cape Town, there are billboards and propaganda everywhere supporting Cape Town as the next place to hold the Olympics. And the slogan that's on the billboards is, "If Cape Town wins, we all win." So that's part of the poem that will come into play later. This is called Cape Town 2004. We keep flying into the daytime. I'll touch down at SeaTac 2 hours later than the time it was when I left Heathrow, though I'm already 7 hours into the second leg of transit. I'm grimy. Altogether, I've been flying for over a day now. Left Johannesburg at 8:15 Wednesday evening. Now it's 8:37 Thursday evening, London time, a city where I've only seen the airport, the city I'm flying away from. I'm going on 41 hours in the same clothes now, 41 hours since my last shower. I say these things as though I have something to complain about. The Khayelitsha skyline is ingrained in my mind, a city of 1.5 million sharing tin shacks and community faucets, a township in the shadow of a city hiding behind Coca-Cola and illuminated mountains, an image I take back to my two-story, two-bath townhouse, to my two city lots of grass and garden. If Cape Town wins, we all win. The slogan strikes me from every direction in a city masking its problems with billboards. I could have come to you and let myself be blinded by these signposts of change. But by digging far enough into you, we outsiders are bound to find reality. South Africa, you are wrapped in fear, despite the legislative attempts to release you. You tied me into your bondage by telling your stories, by giving me the need to help set you free. I fly into an earlier and earlier afternoon. This flying backwards in time, though it wears me thin, shows me that progress is not impossible. The next one I'm going to read reminds me a little bit of Erica's poem, Little Girl Mommies. I wrote it for my big sister, Christy, when she turned 21. It's called Sister with Ink. I remember when we flew down hills on cardboard boxes, flimsy makeshift magic carpets, when we danced and sang our silliness to a world that seemed so much smaller then. We made each other disappear amongst the boxes on the breakfast table. And when left to creativity's devices, woe to the one who should interrupt either of us. Even then, determination ran thick in our veins. And although we never fathomed the scope of the world, we never lost sight of those instinctive claims. Today you are a woman, and I feel so tomboy pixie shy in comparison. Times together grow infrequent, the more we grow into our separate selves. But the distance between us stretches only a fraction of the reaches of childlike imagination. Each artist has discovered her own and embraces it. In everything you do, you run not to finish, but to win. And your art is dear to me for the joy it brings you. I watch you in admiration and offer my art to you. This last one that I'm going to read is called Garden Ritual, and I wrote it a little over a year ago, the night before my 19th birthday. You tell me you worked until midnight the night before I was born. You were set on sleeping, though the labor pains had set in hours ago. Wouldn't go to the hospital until the following morning. 19 years later, I am nocturnal, turning soil after sunset, digging into a day I can no longer separate from sky. I think you've been fooling me all this time. Think that I was born in a field not yet plowed under, grass growing up between my unscathed toes. The roots here harden the soil. I dig and dig and cannot pull myself up. I don't know if it's my roots or this discipline that pulls me under. I need biceps strong enough to lift your shovel, to carry out the plans you've planted for me. I dig in the dirt to find myself wherever I've been hiding. I have a need to make something grow.
Is in honor of the late Allen Ginsberg, who died within the last 6 months, I believe. I'll be reading from a poem of his called Wichita Vortex Sutra. Before I start, let me point out there are a couple of, although there are no four-lettered words in the poem, there are a couple cruder phrases, so I hope that if those offend anyone, they'll forgive that. I hope they don't. I'm an old man now, and a lonesome man in Kansas, but not afraid to speak my lonesomeness in a car, because not only my lonesomeness, it's ours, all over America. Oh, tender fellows, and spoken lonesomeness is prophecy in the moon 100 years ago or in the middle of Kansas now. It's not the vast plains mute our mouths that fill at midnight with ecstatic language when our trembling bodies hold each other breast to breast on a mattress. Not the empty sky that hides the feeling from our faces, nor our skirts and trousers that conceal the body love emanating in a glow of beloved skin, white, smooth abdomen down to the hair between our legs. It's not a God that bore us that forbid our being, like a sunny rose, all red with naked joy, between our eyes and bellies. Yes, all we do is for this frightened thing we call love, want, and lack. Fear that we aren't the one whose body could be beloved of all the brides of Kansas City, kissed all over by every boy of Wichita. Oh, but how many in their solitude weep aloud like me on the bridge over Republican River, almost in tears, to know how to speak the right language. On the frosty broad road uphill between highway embankments, I search for the language that is also yours. Almost all our language has been taxed by war. Radio antennae, high tension wires ranging from Junction City across the plains. Highway cloverleaf sunk in a vast meadow, lanes curving past Abilene to Denver filled with old heroes of love. To Wichita, where McClure's mind burst into animal beauty, drunk, getting laid in a car in a neon-misted street 15 years ago. To an Independence where the old man, still alive, who loosed the bomb that slaved all human consciousness and made the body universe a place of fear. Now speeding along the empty plain, no giant demon machine visible on the horizon, but tiny human trees and wooden houses at the sky's edge. I claim my birthright. Joy reborn after the vast sadness of war gods. A lone man talking to myself. No house in the brown vastness to hear. Imagining the throng of cells that make this nation one body of prophecy. Language by declaration as pursuit of happiness. I call all powers of imagination to my side in this auto to make prophecy. All lords of human kingdoms to come. Shambhu Bharti Baba, naked, covered with ash. Kaki Baba, fat-bellied, mad with the dogs. Deharava Baba, who moans, oh, how wounded, how wounded. Sitaram Amkar Das Thakur, who commands, give up your desire. Satyananda, who raises two thumbs in tranquility. Kali Pada Guha Roy, whose yoga drops before the void. Shivananda, who touches the breast and says, Om. Srimata Krishnayi of Brindavan, who says, take for your guru. William Blake, the invisible father of English visions. Sri Ramakrishna, master of ecstasy eyes half closed, who only cries for his mother. Chaitanya, arms upraised, singing and dancing his own praise. Merciful Chango, judging our bodies. Durga Ma, covered with blood, destroyer of battlefield illusions. Million-faced Tathagat have gone past suffering. Preserver Hare Krishna, returning in the age of pain. Sacred Heart, my Christ, acceptable. Allah, the compassionate one. Yahweh, righteous one. All knowledge, princes of earth, man, all ancient seraphim of heavenly desire. Devas, yogis, and holy men, I chant to come to my lone presence into this vortex named Kansas. I lift my voice aloud, make mantra of American language now. I here declare the end of the war. Let the states tremble, let the nation weep, let Congress legislate its own delight, let the president execute his own desire. This act done by my own voice, published to my own senses, blissfully received by my own form, approved with pleasure by my sensations, manifestation of my very thought, accomplished in my own imagination, all realms within my consciousness fulfilled. 60 miles from Wichita, near El Dorado, the Golden One. In chill earthly mist, houseless brown farmland plains rolling heavenward in every direction. One midwinter afternoon Sunday called the Day of the Lord. Pure spring water gathered in one tower where Florence is set on a hill. Stop for tea and gas.
I'm David Wee from Northfield, Minnesota. I'm going to read two poems. First one, somber one, and the second one, not so somber. The first one I wrote about 2 years ago, a month before my father died. and the poem is entitled Father. I'm on the other side of the planet, but my daughter's letter paints the scene. A steady gray drizzle. The orange U-Haul van doors agape. Your slender granddaughter sits exhausted on the stoop, and you stand in the driveway with mother, weeping. Your dark blue Sunday suit droops over your wasted 89-year-old frame, too weak to lift furniture. In your heart, anger and frustration and will. You have always been a man of action. When the knot wouldn't loosen, you slashed the rope in two with one stroke of the axe. When anyone needed help, you provided it. Today you have nothing to offer but tears. I'm on the other side of the planet, but I want to be there, to hug you, to say that you've paid your dues, that it's okay. All day you have been here in my heart. And the other one I'll read, I wrote about 10 years ago after attending the 1987 World Series when the Twins beat the Cardinals. I am a baseball fan as well as an English professor, and this was published as part of a medley of four poems entitled The English Professor Goes to the World Series. And each of the poems is a parody of a famous British or American poem. And some of the weird lines in the poem will make more sense if you happen to know, like a good English major, you know, the original on which the poem is based.
There won't be a test there, will
there? No test.
Tell us what poem it's based on, or is that from the quiz?
After you read.
You'll know after I tell you the title. It's the glove song of our Kirby Puckett. Let us go then, you and I, to where the ceiling is spread out against the sky like a canvas igloo that has started to melt and sag in the morning. Let us leave the half-deserted skyways and one-way streets that lead like a tedious argument to the overwhelming question. In the dome, the women come and go talking of Joe DiMaggio. The little guy who plants his back against the center field wall, who crosses himself whenever he comes to bat, who licks his tongue at every chance to hit, and every chance to catch a long fly ball or throw a runner out at third. All summer long, our Kirby has gone to the fence, made a sudden leap, and brought us to these soft October nights. In the dome, the men, too, come and go, talking of Joe DiMaggio. And indeed, there will be a time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare, to leave my seat and descend the stair to the bathroom and the crocs of nachos stand with the bald spot in the middle of my hair and my white World Series sweatshirt on my chest to buy another beer and take the risk of missing one of Kirby's magic grabs. In the dome, the women and men come and go talking of Joe DiMaggio. And whether Kirby might be a better fielder, and in time even a better batter than old Joe. I have measured out my life with frosty malts. Amidst the organ music that almost wrecks this place for human habitation. And I have known the arms already, known them all. DiMaggio's, Pafko's, Aaron's, Clemente's, Barfield's, Is it mustard from a brat that makes me so digress? From Kirby's marvelous glove, which after all, as the title reveals, is what this poem is supposed to be about. I should have had a pair of seats in section 105 to see up close Kirby gliding across the floor of this green sea. It is impossible to say just what I mean. No, I am not Sid Hartman or even his close personal friend, full of high sentences. I'm a bit abstruse. I grow old. I grow old. This poem grows long. What was that overwhelming question anyway? And should I then presume? And how should I begin? I should have begun like this. What would we have done without Kirby's glove? Could the twins have come from the dead without it? Is there a better outfielder in all of baseball? And how should I then conclude? How about this? In the dome, the people come and go, talking no more of Joe DiMaggio, but only of Kirby Puckett and his glove. That is what I meant after all.
I'm Doris Johnson from Tigard, Oregon, and I was introduced to Gerald Manley Hopkins in 1976 here at Holden. And these two short poems, I think, speak to me of the area in Holden Village, God's grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, reared, smeared with toil. And where is man's smudge and share of man's smell? The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and through the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward, spring, because the Holy Spirit over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. You think of the tailings and how things are growing in the tailings now. Now picture yourself in the jacuzzi on a starlit night. Look at the stars, look up at the skies. Oh, look at all the fire folks sitting in the air. The bright burrows, the circle citadels there. Down in deep woods, down in dim woods, the diamond delves, the elves' eyes, the gray lawns cold, where gold, where quick gold lies. Wind beat, wind white beam, airy abalese set on a flare, flake doves sent floating forth at a barnyard scare. Ah, well, it is all a purchase, all is a prize.
That's the poem that I was thinking of bringing to read. And once I looked up area fields, I wanted to know what area fields were. And I found out that they're, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they're leaves or trees, shimmering trees. And a perfect example of area fields shining are the tamarack on Buckskin Mountain. On Buckskin Mountain in the fall, when the sun shines through them late in the afternoon, and they just glow. It is shimmering. It was bright flame. I think he uses the word flame too.
I'm Judy Jordan. I'm staff here. And I think I'm just inherently lazy. But if I could write poetry like William Stafford, who's one of my favorite poets, then I'd probably make the effort. But he's so beautiful that I sort of quit before I start. And one of my favorite poems is Traveling Through the Dark, which is one of his most famous. And we used to live in Tillamook, Oregon, and when he talks about the Wilson River Road, It's the road between Tillamook and Portland that we traveled so often and have come upon scenes like this. So it really speaks a lot to me. It's called Traveling Through the Dark. Traveling through the dark, I found a deer dead on the edge of the Wilson River Road. It's usually best to roll them into the canyon. That road is narrow. To swerve might make more dead. By glow of the tail light, I stumbled back of the car and stood by the heap, a doe, a recent killing. She had stiffened already, almost cold. I dragged her off. She was large in the belly. My fingers touching her side brought me the reason. Her side was warm. Her fawn lay there waiting, alive, still, never to be born. Beside that mountain road, I hesitated. The car aimed ahead its lowered parking lights. Under the hood purred the steady engine. I stood in the glare of the warm exhaust turning red. Around our group, I could hear the wilderness listen. I thought hard for us all, my only swerving, then pushed her over the edge into the river.
I'm Paul Pitcher. This time I'm holding for short-term staff, but I've been here many, many, many years. And I didn't really bring up any of the poetry that I've been writing in the last 5 years. I'm also an English major, based in poetry. So that poem's quite interesting. So all the poems I have are what are in my travel journal from coming. I drove from Chicago to California and then up the coast to here. And so I'm going to read three of the ones that I have from that trip and from just being here and kind of having old memories and experience and things. And I'm going to read a couple poems that influenced me. Don't worry, they're all pretty short. There in the distance, Mount Shasta reaches up to greet the sky. Snow-capped peaks tickle the blue canvas and stare down upon the awed traveler, winding up and down the road, drawing nearer to the great monster, who waits, a mystery of peace and beauty. Great green trees form the divider between light and dark, a semblance of some other picture. The moon's eyes glisten above the night's face, casting eerie shadows upon a rushing creek. The sound echoes through the caverns of the mind, sending whispers of gentle night passions among the rocks. The last one I'm going to read about from myself, my dad died a year and a half ago of brain cancer. And this was a place where we lived for 2 years and where I basically grew up. And I always come back here and have a lot of memories. And so a lot of my poetry is dealing with a lot of the emotions that I have in and around that and around everything else. In birth, we are reminded of death. With eyes so dark and penetrating, a raven underneath the cloak of eternity. When lost memories become reborn in haunting dreams of echoing voices, the secrets open slowly as the petals of a black rose. Lines crossing a barren field to keep inside the heart, the echoes of a distant past and a nearer future, locked up under one small body. Okay. And the first English class I took in college was a class all about Yeats. That's the whole class. And the first poem we read of Yeats was not my favorite, but it was kind of, I guess, what really got me into realizing I was going to be an English major. So I'm going to read Sailing to Byzantium. That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long, whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that central music all neglect, monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing, for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, Pern and Agyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past, or passing, or to come. And I debated a long time about the last one I was going to read, because there's so many, because my second class covered all this poetry. But I'm actually going to go into one because of the Vespers tonight, and two because I really like this guy. He's actually my English professor, and his name is David Young. And his poem is called How Music Began. Well, the wind blew so hard that the sea blistered and snapped. Even the boulders were squeaking. Trolls scuffled and spat, whacking thick bones on hollow oaks, screaming for meat, and birds nattered in every thicket. Women in birth pangs howled, bitter couples shattered cups, jugs, and beakers, while children slithered on ice among grit and cinders. Then thunder set off the landslide. Bushes with dead birds tumbled through blasted air. You couldn't hear how bones and trees were splintered, how boulders struck sparks, how the ice burst, taking some of the children. Then quiet grew up, like cave pools cocoons, like very old temples at noon, nursing, fruitful, sketching the buffalo. And then it was easy to consider. Smoke a bird, twisting up, that might sing as the earth got smaller.
Staying in the balcony, if you're done, Paul.
Yeah.
My name is Mark Fias. I'm going to read a Maya Angelou poem titled Still I Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may try me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room? Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed down and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard? Because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide. Welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise.
I have a quick one, two. I'm Michael Anderson, I work in the kitchen.
Yeah.
This one, I'm starting, it's the first part of a longer poem, I think, I'm not sure yet. It was inspired last year by Michelle, a garbologist, and some of the work I did with her, and it continues to be inspired by other great garbologists, called Garbology Imminent. As I slipped my hand in the heavy canvas glove, still ripe and alive with the memories of uncertain juices, my fingertips considered hidden nests of angry grit. I grimaced and shook them out. This soiling of the hands is the first step, I'm told, and I realized. In the glove is empathy latent, garbology imminent. Squeamish, I fingered the butts of cigarettes, sifting ash into buckets, and pointed out the lips, once there, or here, imagined words, last mouth, or tangy smoke breathed, wondered, what hand touched this, made this waste? One of my favorite poets that I discovered this last year at Holden, Thomas Merton, and often think of this poem, Walking in the Village at Night. It's called Evening. Now, in the middle of the limpid evening, the moon speaks clearly to the hill. The wheat fields make their simple music, praise the quiet sky. And down the road, the way the stars come home, the cries of children play on the empty air a mile or more, and fall on our deserted hearing, clear as water. They say the sky is made of glass. They say the smiling moon's a bride. They say they love the orchards and apple trees, the trees their innocent sisters, dressed in blossoms, still wearing in the blurring dusk white dresses from that morning's first communion. And where the blue heaven's fading fire last shines, they name the new-come planets with words that flower on little voices, light as stems of lilies. And where blue heaven's fading fire last shines, reflected in the poplar's ripple, one little wakeful bird sings like a shower.
All right, my name is Sean, and I'm just here holding for the speaker, I guess. And I just started writing poetry, I'd say, just this year, like seriously. And I write in kind of Dr. Seuss style, just because I pretty much look at life as simplistic, and it's easy to understand that way. So this is called The Gravity of Friendship. Well, hellos and highs and deep-minded sighs, welcome back to the front of my brain. So let me explain what is pounding my head before I fall dead or insane. I haven't the faintest what made me say hi, as the rocks and the trees just won't tell me why. The heart is a piece that is taken apart and is set to the rhythm of stop, start, stop, start. So here goes nothing. I am who I am. Walk slowly to everywhere land.
This poem I wrote 3 years ago at Holden. A delight on a hike. Bailey is a delight, especially on a hike. She questions the path. Is it safe? Is it the right way? What does the sign say? Will we be lost? Will Grandpa be lost? Is the end worth the climb? Grandma reassures. We see rocks, lizard, pine cones, tall trees. We hear the falls roar. We feel the cold, cool air. Arrival. Fright is forgotten by a delight in a flight up a long log. Caution turns to daring as Bailey hikes to 10 Mile Creek Falls. Bailey, especially on a hike, is delight. I'll do one more. This one I wrote last December after my husband had become a house husband when I was laid up with a broken ankle. The title is So Now, Is That Fair? And it's written to Charles. 40 years for Israel lost. 40 days of Jesus' test, 40 days and nights of rain, 40 years of husband care, 40 days of sick wife care. So now, is that fair? 63 days in cast, time to read and think of past. Shirley bossed, wheeled, and hopped. Charles cooked, cleaned, and mopped. Chauffeured, shot till he dropped. So now, is that fair? With Shirley on the mend and Christmas cards to send, she mops, cooks, and cleans. Charles has a thought, it seems, of cash pay or 23 years to stay. So now, is that fair? Shirley's loving husband, dear, worked 9 to 9, year to year, prodding, praying, preaching, many people reaching to get the toffees, wraps, and roof. So now, is that fair? So you see, it never is fair. They married to love and to cherish, for better, for worse, in sickness and health, and so they care, though it's not fair. So now, is that fair?
Anyone else? Yes.
I brought in two love poems, neither of which are written to people. The first one is by John Keats, who I read frequently in Patton's, as some of you may know, and is love song to the season of autumn, titled To Autumn. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core. To swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think that warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleamer, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press, with a patient look, thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them, thou hast thy music too, while barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubbled plains with rosy hue. Then in a wailful choir, the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft, the red breast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. The other poem I have is by one of my other favorite poets. And this is considerably less romantic. It's a love song to a car. By E.E. Cummings, titled She Being Brand. She being brand new, and you know, consequently a little stiff, I was careful of her. And having thoroughly oiled the universal joint, tested my gas, felt of her radiator, made sure her springs were A-OK, I went right to it. Flooded the carburetor, cranked her up, slipped the clutch, and then somehow got into reverse. She kicked. What the hell? Next minute, I was back in neutral. Tried, and again, slowly, barely nudging my lever, right, oh, and her gears being in A1 shape, passed from low through second into high like greased lightning. Just as we turned the corner of Divinity Avenue, I touched the accelerator and give her the juice. Good it was. The first ride, and believe I, we was happy to see how nice she acted right up to the last minute. Coming back down by the public gardens, I slammed on the internal expanding and external contracting brakes both at once and brought all of her, trembling, to a dead standstill.
Anyone else? Well, those of us who read, thank those of you who listen. And without either of us, this night would not have happened. Thank you. It's wonderful to hear poetry aloud. We don't do it very much. We don't do it enough to be used to it or to be comfortable with it. And the fact that you are here at all is quite extraordinary. Poetry books don't sell very well in the country, and part of that is that because there are more people writing poetry than there are reading it. And it's an interesting thing to ponder. Anyway, thanks a lot.